WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In addition to your opportunity to vote for president in this November's election, North Carolina voters will be choosing their next governor. The race pits a former seven-time Charlotte Republican mayor making his second gubernatorial run against the Libertarian and the Democratic lieutenant governor. We've already spent an hour with Republican Pat McCrory and another hour with Libertarian Barbara Howe. Now it's Democrat Walter Dalton's turn. Prior to becoming lieutenant governor 4 years ago, Mr. Dalton served six terms in the North Carolina State Senate. He has also run a successful small business as the managing partner of a law firm and served as a county attorney for two decades. After months on the stump, several TV debates, and countless campaign commercials, we have offered the lieutenant governor an opportunity to expand on his vision for the state, and he joins us for the hour from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Thank you for joining us, Governor.
Thank you for the invitation.
Let me ask you what I've asked every candidate who sat in that chair prior to the rest of the interview. Why do you want to be governor of North Carolina?
Because, Mike, I truly do love this state. We've always been a state of opportunity, and particularly educational opportunity. I'm proud of our heritage, that we were the first state to have a public university system, that vision that Terry Sanford had to create a community college system to offer educational opportunity to all of our people. And I see us at a crossroads right now. I want North Carolina to move forward. We've been through tough times. We've seen foreign trade policy, and we've seen the credit crunch superimposed upon our economy and cripple us to a great degree. We were a manufacturing economy, and a lot of those jobs are offshore. But that is the reason I think leadership is more important now than ever before. We have to solve the problems that we face right now, but we need to do so always looking to our future and making sure that we don't damage that future and keep our educational entities strong, our community colleges and our universities, innovate in public education and make sure that we are producing the students that can fill those jobs of the 21st century. And I think it's a critical time in North Carolina's history right now, and I want to lead us forward.
What do you think you have learned from your close proximity to the governor's office as lieutenant governor and also your six terms as a state senator in the legislature? What have you learned about the office of government, governor, what that person can do in the office, and how they have to act and react with the legislature?
Well, I'm elected separately from the governor,
right,
but my experience both as a senator and as lieutenant governor, I think you have to have that close relationship. You have to have that respect. You're not going to agree on everything, but what I have said is that I think as governor, you need to get with that legislative leadership, whoever it may be, and others around the table and and identify what are the problems that we face. I think you can get agreement on that. And then let's talk about the future. Let's talk about our goals. And I think you can get some agreement on that. How you solve the problems, achieve the goals, I think you'll have some differences of opinion. But if you can find a few common threads, then you can begin to weave that fabric of progress and compromise to move North Carolina forward. There will be things that we do not agree upon. And then you come to stations like yours and others, and you use that pulpit you have as governor of North Carolina to take your case to the people. And the other side would take their case to the people, and the people weigh in. But I think that's the way you really tried to move North Carolina forward and can move North Carolina forward. I can give you a specific example of how my style differs that in working with the legislature. The governor vetoed the budget during the short session saying we need more money for education. I agreed with that, but what my statement was, I think she should veto that budget and make them spend $140 million more wisely than they spent it. Because in these tough times when we were laying off thousands of workers, local and state, when we were cutting education, economic development, and health care very deeply, they gave a tax break to people making hundreds of thousands of dollars, equity owners in law practices and dental practices and medical practices, and they did not even ask for it. Hmm. When the budget came out, I said that I felt she should veto it, but make them spend that $140 million more wisely, put it back into education, which would have been my preference, but that or economic development or in health care. It was needed to fill some of those holes. So I've said I am a pragmatic politician, and I think reasonably, had I been in the governor's office, I think I might have had some success in bookending that debate right there. So I think I have learned a great deal about the entire state, every agency of the state. If you look at my opponent, he's never had any experience really in education or health and human services. And as an appropriations chair in the Senate, you get to know every agency of the state, but you also get to know the entire state as you deal with all the different senators, both Democratic and Republican.
You brought up a lot of issues there. We're going to talk about all of them as we go through the hour here. But I want to go to something that you talk about in your campaign literature and on your website, because you, and like many other politicians, talk about learning the importance of community service. Explain that to those who may not understand it and who also may view politicians as opportunists as opposed to public servants, and talk about it in the context of political office, holding political office, community service in the context of holding political office.
That's what political office is about and should always be about, is community service. I think I learned the power of community when my dad had served in the North Carolina Senate when I was 8 years old. But after I came back to Rutherford County to practice law, a group had asked me to speak, and I was going through some of his things, and I actually found a letter from someone out of that community thanking him for getting a road paved back in the early 1950s, and that was a big deal back then. And they talked about how it changed their quality of life, how it changed the economy. And after I spoke to that group, I mentioned that, some people came up and they said they remembered the day that road was paved, and they remembered what he had done. And I thought, well, how powerful. 25 to 30 years later, he had done something to make a difference for that community. And that's what public service is about, should be about. That's what community service is about. You know, when I was in the Senate, you don't get paid very much to serve in the North Carolina General Assembly. But someone said, and I agree, it's that psychological income that you get, knowing you're helping your fellow man, knowing you're helping to build that better future. And I think that leadership is even more important in the tough times to make sure we don't forget about that future. But I think community is everything. After my dad died, I look, and it was the community that got behind me, men in his Rotary Club or people out of my church, mm-hmm. that took an interest in me and took me hunting and fishing, got me involved in athletics. And to a great degree, athletics became a surrogate for me. I played high school sports, didn't have the talent to go beyond that. But you learn discipline, you learn teamwork, you learn humility. And so, you have to have a strong community. Let me give you one real quick story. I did a small business listening tour after I became lieutenant governor in about 25 venues across the state, because I realized our economy was riding on the backs of small business. But the very first tour, I looked at a gentleman and I said, what can we do to make your small business stronger? And he looked back at me and says, what can you do to make my community stronger? And I thought it was a great answer. It was actually an area of North Carolina that was losing population. That is unusual. As a state, we are gaining population. I had expected to hear about taxes and regulation and access to credit, and I did. But none of those things matter unless you have people coming through that door for your goods and services. That's the reason you need a strong community. Mm-hmm. And reflecting back again to Terry Sanford, to create that community college system, that anchors a lot of communities and gives them hope and gives them opportunity.
One of your opponents, Barbara Howe, the Libertarian candidate, I don't believe has held public office, but she has tried many, many, many times at various different levels in the state to hold political office. So she's somebody who desires it. Pat McCrory was 7-time mayor of Charlotte, and prior to that was on city council. So he spent a lot of time, and as a mayor, I will tell you from personal experience observing him here in Charlotte, he worked practically 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You have have served six terms in the state Senate. You've chaired your local community college, board of trustees, served on lots of nonprofit boards, were a county attorney for almost 20 years. You ran for lieutenant governor. And it seems that in North Carolina, well, in Charlotte, for instance, the power of the mayor is very limited. The power of the governor in North Carolina seems limited to me, and the power of lieutenant governor is even more limited. You were in the state Senate. You held the seat for six terms. Your father had that same seat before you. Why did you want to be lieutenant governor? Why give up what seems to be greater power and influence and move into that spot?
Well, Mike, you know, there was that opportunity. Governor Perdue was lieutenant governor, ran for governor, and I saw it as an opportunity. The lieutenant governor does not have a lot of constitutional power, but you can kind of make the office what you want to make it, and I've tried to do that. One thing I did as a senator, I introduced something called the Innovative Education Act back in 2003, but it laid a foundation for early college high schools throughout North Carolina. Today we have about 75. It's a collaboration between public schools and an institution of higher learning, a community college or a four-year university. And it's a five-year program. You enter in the ninth grade, and in 5 years you either have a technical degree or you have 2 years of college. Normally that takes 6 years. It ups the rigor, it accelerates learning, it saves parents and students money, and better prepares our students for the 21st century economy. It has been very successful. The New York Times has said it is a model for the nation. But I wanted to do even more with that. So I went to the legislature as lieutenant governor, and I said, I want you to create something called the Jobs Commission, joining our businesses and our schools, because we need to work together. Business has been critical that they're not getting the product they need for this knowledge-based economy. Let's get business involved. And when I went to the legislature, and at that time it was controlled by Democrats, but I said, I want Republicans and Democrats on this commission. I want House and Senate members on this commission. I want education and business leaders on this commission. And we brought that commission together, and then I said, I want to travel to the seven distinct economic development regions across the state because the economy differs. And what I want to do is ask, where is your economy now? Where do you want it to be? What are the skills that you're going to need? And let's see if we can align an early college high school with those skills so people can be interested in that. And I wanted the commission members to understand that North Carolina is different throughout. Not every region is the same. It's not just like where you live. And I think that was very, very successful. I wanted the people to know that we're not going to be Raleigh-centric. We're going to listen to you. And we've created some very successful programs. There's an agri-science, agribusiness, biomanufacturing initiative in the Northeast involving five counties. At Cumberland, near Fort Bragg, a language and global studies, 62 languages are spoken in Cumberland County. Every Special Forces soldier is versed in a foreign language. They have hundreds of jobs in their language lab that they can't fill. So we program this so those kids would have that opportunity, whether they go to work there or not. Having that language skill is a great 21st century skill. And then one in STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, focused on the 14 grand challenges of engineering. That school has been invited to present at the World Conference of Engineers next year in Argentina. And the key, Mike, is 60% of the kids in these early colleges are first generation. And many of the schools have 40% free and reduced lunch. But the graduation rate is almost 100%. The dropout rate is almost zero. Again, seven of the top 10 high schools last year for graduation were early college high schools. A lot of people worked on that across this state, but I had a lot to do with it too. And as lieutenant governor, I took that jobs commission. We actually won an award. My jobs commission won an award for Innovator of the Year from the Southern Growth Policy Council. That is made up of the 13 southeastern states, and the governors of those states serve on that, most of them Republican. But we won that award not because of politics, because it was good.
Let me jump in here and stop you for a second. We're going to come back and talk about a lot of different issues with Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton, obviously running for governor, when we continue Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the American Turkish Association. The Turkish Festival in Charlotte, food, music, and kids activities, 11 to 5 this Saturday, Oasis Shriners Auditorium near the university's Sam's Club. Tickets at charlotteturks.org. Well, the debates are behind us in North Carolina. Well, except for the gubernatorial debate, there's one more of those. Early voting has started. Election day is but 2 weeks away. So we're going to take a look at where the presidential race is now and what the result may hinge on. We'll also examine the race for governor in the state and at some of the congressional races of local interest. And we're going to examine the potential impact of early voting on all of this and take your calls with Dr. Michael Bitzer, our political blogger here at WFAE from Catawba College. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Republicans are pushing efforts to crack down on voter fraud. Others say the problem is extremely rare. Debate over the scope of voter fraud and what's being done to prevent it.
That's the topic on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are continuing our series of conversations with the three candidates for governor in North Carolina. We spoke first with Pat McCrory, the seven-time Charlotte mayor Republican candidate, Barbara Howe, the Libertarian, who I think has run two or three times before as well, and now Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton, the Democratic candidate. What do you believe is the greatest challenge facing North Carolina today, and what do you think you could do about it as governor?
Well, obviously, I think the economy right now is our greatest challenge. People wonder why this recession has been so deep, particularly for North Carolina. If you look, we're having to reinvent our economy to a great degree. As I said, we had fast-track legislation back around 2003 that really accelerated our job loss offshore. We were losing jobs to NAFTA-CAFTA, but actually we were transitioning that fairly well. But really, that fast-track legislation accelerated it rapidly. But this recession is like none other because I grew up in a textile town. I remember recessions. The orders would go down. People would get laid off. Then the orders would come back, and they would go back to work. There's no place to go back to work now. That's the reason this recession is deeper. We are really having to reinvent our economy. So that means investing in education, though, and innovation and creativity and entrepreneurship. That's what's going to create that new economy. That's the reason I was so concerned about the depth of the education cuts that we saw in this last General Assembly. As I said before, we have to fix our problems, but as you fix the problems, don't lose sight of the future. You know, I've said the recovery really will be in two phases. If you look where the jobs are today, there are jobs in the health sciences. Baby boomers are getting older. We need nurses, nurses assistants, radiologists, technicians, people to work in nursing homes. There are jobs in biotech. Actually, during the recession, North Carolina saw an increase in jobs in biotech, and that's biomanufacturing. That's manufacturing jobs all the way to research. We have jobs in the military economy. We're growing that, and if you look at my economic plan, I show ways that we can grow it even more rapidly. And then in entrepreneurship, as I said. But then if you look at those jobs in the future, what we have to create, you know, new economies are really created by new inventions, cutting-edge research, and that's the reason the cuts to our public university system hurt so badly, because we have some great research institutions doing great things. There in Charlotte, at UNC Charlotte, when I was in the Senate, we helped fund some of the research for bioinformatics and photonics. That is something very important to the banking industry, the health industry, the insurance industry. It moves information at the speed of light, but it is very secure. We need to have those types of investments to build, to repair the economy now, but build for the future. I was in Charlotte not long ago at a company called Inventus, and they take all kinds of ideas, and if it's a good one, they'll help you bring it to market. But one of the products they had was a piece of fabric, and it looked like polyester, but it was part of the results of that bioinformatics research. And it's actually, if you wore a coat, you could power your cell phone with it. And that sounds a little funky, I guess. But if you're in the military and you pitch a tent in the desert, you can power the computer and some other electronics with that because of the bioinformatics. That's the type of thing that will create a new economy. So our greatest challenge is to solve the problems that we have right now, get people back to work. But in doing so, build for the future and make sure that we don't cut so deeply that we destroy some of the things that have made North Carolina very special. And I think those things are a great public university system that has really been seen as a model for the nation and really the world, and a community college system that is seen, I think, as probably the best in the United States, the third largest, but I think the most affordable, accessible, and excellent. Dubai actually came here a few years ago to look at our university system because they thought that that university system was the best in the world. To damage that damages our future. But I think those are the challenges that we face.
But, of course, let's start with education, because before you get to the university system or before you get to the community college level, you have to go through primary education. And that's suffering in North Carolina, at least we're told it is. You point out that we did not close our public schools or fire a single teacher during the Great Depression. We did, however, during this recession. Why the different approach, and who was responsible for taking us down this different path?
Well, as far as during the Great Depression, Omax Gardner and his vision and his commitment to education got us through that time, and I applaud him. He understood the power of education. Quite frankly, when the legislature changed power structure and the Republicans took over, they came in with a very ideologic view of the budget. They said they would come in and cut fraud and waste. Democrats came forward with a more balanced approach. Let's close the hole 2/3 in cuts and 1/3 in revenues that were there but were set to expire. They said, no, we will find it all in fraud and waste. But cutting 6,000 need-based financial aid students off of their scholarship, I don't think was fraud and waste. Cutting Smart Start and More at Four by 20%, which the courts, and it was a Republican judge, said that's unconstitutional, is not fraud and waste. To cut economic recruitment money when we're working for jobs in Virginia and South Carolina, we're appropriating more money, that's not fraud and waste. And to cut $1 billion out of health care where jobs do exist, I don't think that was fraud and waste. So I think what you saw was an ideologic approach that I don't think served our people well. When Governor Martin was there working with the Democratic legislature, he actually proposed a balanced approach of revenues and cuts, half and half. So, again, what I said before, you have to solve the problems, but don't do it in such a way that it damages your future.
But the reality is here that we have a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor, and should you take the office of governor, you will be a Democratic governor and probably face a Republican legislature. So what power does the governor have to counter what the legislature wants to do in this area of education?
Well, you have certainly the bully pulpit to get your voice out there, but my first effort would be to work with that legislature. I think if you look at my economic recovery plan and education plan, I think we can get a lot of agreement. And I show how you do that without raising the sales tax. My opponent has attacked me saying I'm proposing a sales tax increase when I become governor. I've never done that. And the NNO has fact-checked that and said that that ad is false. I think I can bring the leadership together and we can get an agreement on a lot of the things that I propose in both the education plan and economic recovery plan. I propose to repair all of those cuts to the early childhood education and actually expand it. I think, in the last 10 years, North Carolina has improved on its graduation rate steadily. We need to do more, but part of that is that we began to invest in early childhood education, which the Federal Reserve, a very conservative body, has said is probably the best dollar you can spend in education, yet they cut it to an unconstitutional level. I think I could get them around the table and say, look, this is the way you pay for it. We're not going to raise the sales tax, and let's agree that we're going to move North Carolina forward. If that's not successful, then as governor, you do have the veto. I think I would use that more sparingly, hopefully getting agreement earlier on. But if it is used, it is not to draw a line in the sand, but it is to continue that work and engage the people of North Carolina and let them weigh in. Take this last session. Do the people of North Carolina really support $140 million for a tax cut for people making hundreds of thousands of dollars who are not suffering in this economy? Or would they prefer that put in education to invest in early childhood that was unduly cut and unconstitutionally cut? Shouldn't we take some of that money and repair it? I come on your station. I come on the stations across North Carolina. Phil Berger and Tom Tillis can come on. We can debate that, and I think the people will engage. And so one of us is probably going to have to give on that. I think it will be them.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but this is a common theme among Democratic candidates for public office from the president on down, that the Republicans want to give tax cuts to people who don't need them and who are not suffering from this economic situation that we are in. And the Republicans counter to say that if we give these tax cuts, it creates more jobs, because these are the people who create jobs. These are the entrepreneurs. These are the business people. Since the legislature has done this, have more jobs been created? Don't spend a lot of time on this, but just give me an answer.
What I would like to answer is the proposal my opponent has, because that's the trickle-down theory.
I want to know if it works. I want to know if it works. Have you witnessed anything?
No, I don't think it does work in that fashion. To give you the example, my opponent has said he wants to take the corporate tax to zero. He wants to give people that are worth more than $5 million a tax break, and he wants to lower the personal income tax. Well, that may sound good, but you've got to look at the other side of it. It creates a $10 to $11 billion hole. This is the Budget and Tax Center talking, a nonprofit, nonpartisan group. And when you ask, well, how are you going to fill that hole, Mayor McCrory, he says, well, raise consumption taxes. But he will not give the details on the consumption taxes. But the dictionary says that is generally sales tax and tax on services, haircuts, doctor's visits, things like that. The Budget and Tax Center says with his plan, 80% of the people in North Carolina will see a tax increase, and a substantial one. When asked about the detail, he has refused to give it. But after the last debate, his campaign was asked, why will you not give us the detail on your tax plan? And their answer was, because if we do, we know it will be dead on arrival. Now, the people need to hear that, because it is no plan. With that type of comment out of his campaign, you know that the people are not going to be receptive of that. 80% of the people will see a tax increase. When you cut one place, it pops out another place. So I believe in a bubble-up economy, Mike. A bubble-up economy is when you give people the tools to compete. I've said it's not competition when one team walks on the field with new uniforms and the best coaching. The other team walks on barefooted and they don't know the rules. But when you equip everybody, everybody gets better. And that tool to compete today is in education. So that's the reason we need to make sure that we're solid on education, improving our public schools, and maintaining the best community college system and university system in the nation.
Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton is our guest in the third of a series of conversations we've had with the other two candidates for governor, Barbara Howe, the Libertarian, Pat McCrory, the Republican. Barbara Howe was excluded from the gubernatorial debates in North Carolina, of which there is one more next week. Should she have been?
I welcome her to any and all debates. When I debated as lieutenant governor, and those were more limited, we had the Libertarian candidate included. And I think any public discourse by people who want to serve, you know, in office, I think is good for the people. So, you know, I know that some of the people who sponsor these things want to see a certain level of support before they include them. I know in our primary, we had six people in the primary. I understand that perhaps makes it more difficult for the people sponsoring the debate. But I welcome any and all discourse for the public to consider.
Let's get back to education, because you want to restore, these are your words, you want to restore and protect public education by aligning it with job needs. What does that mean? Does that mean focusing classes on vocational needs versus higher educational needs? What does it mean?
No, it means what I was talking about with that jobs commission.
Okay.
And it can be technical degrees. What I learned in traveling around is that a lot of people say not everybody needs a four-year degree, and I think they are absolutely right. But most people are saying, but you're going to need something beyond high school today, because we are more knowledge-based. We're not the manufacturing economy we once were. I think that is right. And I have said if you erased all of public education today, You wouldn't draw a traditional four-year high school. You would do something like these five-year programs that I have been very involved in and helping to create.
So how does this plan differ from Pat McCrory's proposal to create a two-track high school system with one track that leads toward college and the other leading toward vocational education?
It differs substantially because it is not a track. Now, what he does is actually, if you follow what he's talking about, you would pretty much have to take a 15-year-old and say, well, you're not going to go to college. We'll put you on a vocational track. You're defining a 15-year-old's career before that 15-year-old has a chance to define himself or herself. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that is right. In the early college program, they can be geared toward technical degrees. They can be geared toward language and global studies, as I talked about, STEM education. We can focus these things. But what you're trying to do is capture the dream of a kid. I was at an early college one time that was STEM-oriented, science, technology, engineering, and math. I looked at a kid. I said, why are you going to the early college? He said, because I want to be a rocket scientist. And I have said traditional high school has a flashing sign saying, come here, we'll teach you algebra, geometry, physics, English, and history. He looked at that early college, and he saw a flashing sign in his mind anyway that says, come here, and you can be a rocket scientist. Hmm. They're going to teach algebra, history, geometry, and English, but it was that connection to the real world. That's what we try to do with the early colleges, that captures the imagination of these kids and gives them a dream. I said, as a high school athlete, I wanted to be a Joe Namath or a Johnny Unitas. I was never going to be that, but wanting to be that made me a better high school athlete. Catching that kid's dream and putting that into the curriculum, that real-world experience, but make sure they get the skills to compete is what's going to be key. So I'm not tracking anyone, although we are gearing these things toward some vocational experiences, career tech, type experiences, and some of them are going to be two-year college programs. But it's very easy, I think, for a kid to move from one area to the other. What my opponent would do is very much define someone's career before I think they've defined themselves.
We've talked some about funding for education, for public education, for education at the college level, et cetera. And some people say, particularly if the public schools get enough money, that money isn't the problem and it isn't the solution, that school choice and competition is the solution. And I know that your opponent, Pat McCrory, is very much in favor of charter schools. Others call for vouchers to allow students to attend the school of their choice. So where do you fall on all of this?
Well, I think he's actually embraced vouchers for private schools. Mm-hmm. Let me hit the first thing on the funding. If we're going to compete against other states and other countries, then we're going to have to out-educate them. If we're going to compete with them to recruit jobs, we're going to have to out-educate them because we are a knowledge-based economy. Money is not everything. You have to prioritize the money. But cutting to the depth that we've seen to be one of the states with the lowest per pupil funding in the nation does not bode well for our future. Now, on the issue of school choice, I think charter schools most definitely have a role in education. But I agree with what John Dornan, who was head of the Public School Forum, said early on. His greatest disappointment was that schools of education did not try to charter schools and conduct clinical practices across the state and use those charter schools to research and develop best practices that could then be shared through our traditional public schools. I think that is a really good model. I think charter schools should have a focus. I also think they should be more transparent. As you know, a charter school, only 50% of the teachers have to be certified teachers. So you can bring someone in that's not a certified teacher. They are funded at the state salary schedule, but they don't have to pay them on the salary schedule. Where does that extra money go? Does it go into technology? Does it go in to help the kids? Or does it go into the pocket of the people that own or run the charter school? My opponent has supported in public comment something called K-12 Inc., which is a virtual charter, but it is being investigated in other states for fraud because it's pocketing that money and the performance of the kids is not very good.
Let me stop you there. We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to finish up on education, move to businesses and taxes and energy, and take some listener phone calls and share some emails with you as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Anderson Heating and Cooling, full service air conditioning installation and repair, serving residential communities for more than 28 years. Information at 704-596-2525. And the Charlotte Symphony. Christoph Perrick returns to conduct Smetana's powerful Moldau and Schumann's Symphony No. 1, November 2nd and 3rd in the Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. Environmental issues and the 2012 campaign, the topic of the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, what President Barack Obama and former Governor Mitt Romney say and don't say about energy independence, environmental regulations, and climate change. That's at 10. If you'd like to join our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Hello, it's Garrison Keillor reminding you that A Prairie Home Companion is heard at 6 o'clock on Saturday, 12 noon on Sunday, right here on 90.7 WFAE. Hope you'll join us for music and comedy and, of course, the news from Lake Wobegon. Saturdays at 6, Sundays at noon on listener-supported WFAE Charlotte's NPR News station.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. 2 weeks ago, Pat McCrory was here. Last week, Barbara Howe was here. Today, Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton is here. All three of them running for governor. Mr. Dalton is the Democratic candidate. We'll take some phone calls and share some emails in a moment. But I want to finish on education first very quickly. You want to make higher education more affordable and accessible. Some people are leaving college now saddled with loans that they will never repay or that will cripple their early adulthood lives because they can't repay these loans well. How would you do this? How would you make it more affordable and accessible?
Well, one thing I would do, and this is in accordance with something that Erskine Bowles has always encouraged, is that encourage more of the students to get that first 2 years at the community college. They're under stress also, but they do a wonderful job. My opponent has made the statement that community colleges were never meant to be junior colleges or to give high school degrees. I don't think Terry Sanford would like that comment. I don't think that's so, and I don't think Erskine would agree with that. Those two-year programs are very, very valuable, and you can get that education for a fraction of the cost that you would have at the four-year university. So first, I would encourage that. In addition, if you look at my plan, it funds education differently, higher education differently. It does not fund it strictly on seat time and enrollment. There would be a component there for course completion and degree completion. So there is a performance-based measure there for our universities, which I think will make them more efficient in making sure that those people who enroll complete the course, complete the degree. And so and also just in funding in general, trying to keep tuition down. I will tell you this. When I was in the North Carolina Senate and chaired education, chaired appropriation, there were tuition increases, but there was also always an offsetting amount for need-based financial aid. In fact, you will see that need-based financial aid was increased dramatically much faster than the increases in tuition. In this last session, the first time I've ever seen it, tuition went up and financial aid went down, which I think is really a formula for disaster in the long run. And against the DNA of North Carolina, we've always valued this opportunity for education, being the first public university, and wanting people to have that opportunity to be the best that they can be. One of the ways to do that, though, is to really focus on getting students to get that first 2 years at a community college. Statistically, it shows that they transfer in very well to a four-year university, and building dormitories and cafeterias is very capital-intensive, so we save a lot of money on bricks and mortar, and I think we can do a better job in that fashion.
Let's go to the phones and begin with Marion in Southern Pines. Welcome to the program, Marion.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call, and it's just a real honor to be able to speak with Lieutenant Governor Dalton. The main thing, Mr. Dalton, I want to thank you so much for so many years of service to the state of North Carolina. I actually grew up in Raleigh, and I actually attended a private school there. But because of the education I received, it just instilled in me, you know, the absolute importance of education. And I can't thank you enough for all that you have done and are doing and will do on behalf of education. That does lead to a really good education, leads certainly to a good job, a quality family life, rich cultural resources, and nearby in we have our you know, community college over in Pinehurst and Sandhills Community College. And I can tell you that my brother Patrick graduated from there, and he went on to North Carolina State to complete two master's degrees in engineering. So that's my response to your opponent in part, as far as his position on community college.
Do you have a question, Marion?
Yeah, my question is, what would you do as far as the, we have that three-quarter penny sales tax that provided so much funding for education, and then when the Republicans came in, they, repealed that, or it expired, and they didn't renew it. And I just want to say, you know, as a senior on a...
Do you have a question, Marion?
Yeah, my question is, would you consider restoring that? Because that's the
okay.
way that
you,
I, as a
all
senior...
All right, will you consider restoring that?
Okay. What I have said is, Governor, I do not propose any increase in the sales tax. I did support the proposal to extend three-quarters of a penny for this last two-year term. I thought the $2.4 billion in cuts was undue. Again, the Democratic proposal, two-thirds in cuts and one-third would have been in the extension of less than a penny. That's that 15% he talks about. But I've never, ever proposed that as governor. What I said for that biennium, for that budget, we were still in hard times. If you look at my education plan, I show where we can access the money without raising the sales tax, without raising any tax other than that $140 million I talked about. I would pull that back in.
Okay.
But I am not proposing any increase in the sales tax as governor, but I show ways that we can restore that funding without doing that and, you know, again, invest in early childhood and those other things that I think will be very important. I do like her example, Dr. Kirk over there at Sandhills. I've been to that campus, and they do a great job there, and that is the type of example I think Erskine Bowles would be proud of, too.
Marion, thank you for your call. Let me go to Nathan in Dudley Shoals. Welcome, Nathan.
Hey, good morning. Thank
morning.
You for taking the call. I've been watching the debates and listening to what is being said by both candidates, and I built a house about 3.5 years ago, and taxes, it seems like, ever since we filed our first income tax return. Till now, our return has gotten substantially less. And about the insurance homeowners proposal, 18%, 30% on the coast, and with all the other taxes that were being taken out of our checks by week, what can he do, or what's going to be done to limit our taxes?
Are you talking about property taxes, or are you talking about state income taxes?
Both property taxes, 18%.
Okay. Is there anything a governor can do either about property taxes or about insurance fees?
The insurance fees, I would suggest you get the candidates for the Commissioner of Insurance, because that's a constitutional office, and really that's more in their jurisdiction. But on the taxes, again, I point out I am proposing no tax increases, but the Budget and Tax Center has said that his proposal will raise taxes on 80% of North Carolina families, raise taxes on the middle class, working families, senior citizens on fixed income.
But property taxes fall under the county that you live in, correct?
Yeah. You're asking me?
Yes.
I mean, I thought he said all taxes.
Well, he does, yes, but he's talking about he bought a house and how the taxes keep going up on the house. But that's property tax, and that's a county thing, right?
Well, no, not really. If you look at his proposal, he wants to say corporations pay zero. It's going to put more burden on the middle class, okay, working families, senior citizens. He talks about a Florida model. Florida, if you look at their property taxes, they are at least four times higher generally than I think any place in North Carolina, because what happens is, as they're trying to make the budget fit, they push more responsibility back to local governments, they have to raise their taxes. So it all comes together. And if you're going to give the tax relief to big corporations like he's talking about and to people worth over $5 million. It's the rest of us that will have to pay one way or another.
Thank you for your call, Nathan. You advocate, I believe, cutting taxes for small businesses and for employers who hire long-term unemployed residents. How do you know that such a tax cut would generate more jobs?
Well, I think it will. I mean, generally, you see, what we're talking about, if anybody's been unemployed for 6 months or more, a $2,000 tax credit to the business that will hire them. Also, there is a train-to-hire provision that I have, and I have a specific plan. He has no plan, but I have a specific plan. Train-to-hire is anybody that's unemployed. If you want to hire them for 8 weeks at 24 hours a week, and they can draw a partial unemployment benefit, and that way the company can test them out, then I think that is a very productive way to bring people back to work, to make sure the employer gets an employee that he feels confident with. Other states have actually saved money on unemployment by doing that. So I think if you look at those two or three things, cutting taxes on small business, letting startups sell their tax credits to access money for capital, hire the long-term unemployed, give a benefit for that, do the train to hire, I think in a very short period of time we can put people back to work, and I think I can get that passed in the legislature and I show how to pay for it.
So your opponent would like to cut or lower corporate income taxes because he says they have the highest in the Southeast. I think you don't believe in that, but you do believe that we should make out-of-state business compete for our incentives. I thought we were competing for that business with other states, not the other way around.
Well, what I'm saying there is North Carolina is generally seen as a good place to do business. If you look at Forbes magazine, Site Selection, CEO, and others, and we seem to run after every business that is anywhere. Now, 60% to 70% of the incentives go to in-state businesses, which I approve of. But as we recruit, I think that we should focus, regionally, and say that this is it's kind of like a sale at one of the department stores or something. Invite the companies in and say we have a finite benefits that we can offer for those companies that are going to move us forward, pay more than the average wage, give benefits, invest money in our tax base here, come to North Carolina for this period of time, and we're recruiting you. And then make them compete for what we have rather than chasing every company that may come around the corner. There will be exceptions to the rule. But I think you can get a more organized fashion of recruitment that would pay us dividends at less cost.
And here's something that came up when we talked to Pat McCrory about this very thing about providing incentives to attract business here. And sometimes the businesses don't hold up their end of the bargain, or sometimes they leave at a significantly shorter period of time than we hoped they would stay. And it came up, what about businesses who are already here? What about incentives for them?
They're there. And if you look at any company that's recruited out of state, any in-state business that would do what that company says they would do can access that, because the legislation is always generic. So, and actually, as I said just then, 60 to 70% of our incentives go to in-state companies that are growing jobs that will pay, generally the standard is more than the average wage in the area, that will give benefits to their employees, and that invest substantial dollars in the tax base. And it'll be targeted to different things. So the key there is a lot of companies, in fact, I would say most companies in North Carolina probably are not paying at that higher rate because there is usually some benefit out there for them.
Pat McCrory talks about unleashing North Carolina's energy resources to help power our economy. And I believe that would open the door to offshore drilling and fracking. You advocate a comprehensive energy plan that pursues both traditional and alternative energy resources, one that balances economic needs with environmental obligations. Your words. Can you go into greater detail, and would that include offshore drilling and or fracking?
It does include that. I say if it can be done safely, but now I will tell you this. His jobs plan is based on fracking and offshore drilling. By his own words, that is 6 to 10 years out. We need jobs now. I have a specific plan to put people back to work now and build those jobs for the future. On fracking, I will say this. Our own Department of Environment and Natural Resources says it can be done safely on the drilling. It will not create earthquakes, and we can preserve the quality of water. I'll accept that, but the one thing that has not been addressed is the supply of water, because where you're talking The location of the shale is in rural areas that depend on well water. Fracking takes a lot of water, and those are areas that have experienced drought. So I would want to make sure that we can be safe and that it doesn't damage the supply of water. But even on those studies, it's only 380 jobs 6 to 10 years out. Offshore drilling is really a federal issue, but the president of the American Petroleum Institute on C-SPAN not too long ago said if the feds open it back up, they're not going to go off the east coast of America. They're going to go back to the Gulf where the bigger supplies are. They already have the infrastructure there, and that's where the refineries are. So if he's putting all his eggs in that basket, which he is, it's not a good basket to have them in. I am all for a comprehensive approach to energy, and we need to look at that, and we need to get off of foreign oil. But, you know, I think to a degree, I question whether those are political platitudes, because if you look at the objective evidence, there is a real question whether either one of those economies will ever be created. And we can't put all our eggs in those baskets.
Before we run out of time, I want to bring this home to Charlotte. The state's economy is shifting from rural agricultural interests to urban interests, and yet Charlotte and the Charlotte region has often felt misunderstood and neglected by Raleigh. To many there, we are the great state of Mecklenburg, and that's meant to be a derisive characterization. Now we have Tom Tillis from Huntersville as Speaker of the House, Pat McCrory, a seven-time Charlotte mayor, running for governor. Some believe that would be good for Charlotte. Would you be just as good? Do you understand the needs of this city and other urban areas?
I understand the needs, and you have to be about all of North Carolina. If you're going to be governor of North Carolina, you have to be about all of North Carolina. But in the Senate, you have your Center City Classroom. I was involved in the appropriation for Center City Classroom. You have the EPIC building program there. I was involved in that appropriation. Bioinformatics, photonics at UNC Charlotte, I was involved in that. I have done a logistics task force report showing how we can leverage the great job that Jerry Orr does out at the airport. You've got 6,000 acres. You can be as big as the Atlanta airport, which I think is the largest in the world. Moving people and goods through North Carolina is absolutely critical. The Piedmont Atlantic region is listed as the eighth hottest spot in the world today for the next 20 to 30 years for economic development. If we can move people and goods, that runs from Raleigh all the way to Atlanta. Charlotte may be jealous of Raleigh because they think Raleigh gets everything. I will tell you, Raleigh is jealous of Charlotte. They think Charlotte gets everything. The urban areas think the rural areas get too much. The rural areas think the urban areas get too much, and the East thinks the West gets it, and the West thinks the East gets it. It is one state. We have to work together, and I am the one that will lead us and pull us together.
Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton running for office of governor, as a Democrat. One more gubernatorial debate coming up next week. At the you can listen to all of the conversations we've had with our two other candidates for this office on our website at wfae.org. Lieutenant Governor Walter Dalton, thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.